The names of the Anishinaabe are many. Ojibwe, Chipewyan, Ojibwa, Chippewa, all united by a shared history of clans, language, and culture. All identify the thousands of politically autonomous bands and tribes which make the Chippewa Nation the largest tribe in North America. Most significant among these shared political and cultural backgrounds are the spiritual practices and values of the Grand Medicine Society and its teachings, which continue today. Among the smallest of the Native American reservations in Wisconsin today, Red Cliff was originally part of the La Pointe Band, the primary village of the Great Buffalo, head chief of the Anishinaabe. That's taken from Miskwabic on History on the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa website. Our guest today is a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Michael Laughing Fox Charette is a gifted Native American musician, storyteller, and poet. As a self-taught Native flute player, he enhances his stories with hauntingly beautiful flute and drum performance. Growing up surrounded by the beauty of Lake Superior and the woods led him to dedicate his gifts as an artist to gently teaching about Native history, culture, and spirituality. Michael Laughing Fox Charette, welcome to Route 51.
Aho, chi mi gwich, bonjour, everyone. Bonjour, indunaway, maganiduk. Hello to all my relatives. Papewa gush, nindajinikaj. Laughing Fox is my name. Miskwabi Kong, Nindunjaba. Red Cliff is where I'm from. Nindamikizi, du dame. I am of the Eagle Clan. And what I have just said is a traditional Ojibwe greeting in the Anishinaabe language, in the Ojibwe language.
Thank you so much for that, Michael. As I read from your history just now, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are also known as Ojibwe, Anishinaabe. What are the meanings of these names, and is there a preference among your members?
Yeah, there's different stories within every different village, you know, and I can only talk to my village and my experiences and my teachings to that. So I apologize if my teachings are the stories stray a little bit from today's listeners. The Anishinaabe is a old name which an Algonquin people, speaking people, like to call themselves, and we associate ourselves as Anishinaabe people. And there have been other names that we have been called. And one of them is Chippewa, which we currently use, as you had stated, the Red Cliff Band, Lake Superior Chippewa. And I had heard, you know, that Chippewa isn't really like who we are. Like Chippewa is a reference to another village, which is Bawating, which is Sault Ste. Marie. And Chippewa really means like the people of the rapids, or so I've heard, people of the rapids. And that, you know, when the government had its dealings with us, you know, they kind of used that and categorized us all into one big group. And then another name we're known as is the Ojibwa or the Ojibwe. And some people tell us that that's actually, a style of moccasin that we wear, or the style that we do when we make our moccasins. And which is kind of funny, you know, because if you want to talk about a tribe, you know, and you're calling them, you know, like the style of their moccasins, you know, the Ojibwe tribe, you know, that's kind of like saying, oh, there's a Nike tribe out there or a Reebok tribe out there. So I always find that kind of funny, you know, and people will break up that word Ojibwe into a deeper meaning, which is usually the way that it goes with the Anishinaabe language and the Anishinaabe words. But our people do use, when we speak in prayer, we use Anishinaabe when we recognize our spirits and our people.
Now, Michael, you were given the name, as you mentioned, Bape Wagush, Laughing Fox, which is also the name you use as a musician, storyteller, when you were about 10 years old. How did you receive that name, and how do you use it now to inspire and empower others?
Yes, Bape Wagush is my spirit name, my spiritual name. It's a name that was given to me before I sought out a vision quest. And, you know, a long time ago, our language and culture was outlawed, so the grandmothers kept it secret. So I didn't really start learning about the culture until I was about 10 years old. And after I started to learn about it, I wanted to take part in it. And one of the things, when you come of age, one of the things that you do is you go out and seek a fast or a vision quest, you know, to commune with the spirits around you. And I wanted to do this as you know, as a way of bringing it back. And so I sought out a person who knew the naming ceremony and gave them an offering of tobacco and gifts. And they in turn talked to the spirits. And that following spring, they had dreamt a name for me, and we did ceremony. And then after I had received my Anishinaabe name, Pape Wagush, I was put out into the woods where I fasted for a few days without food or water.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your spiritual journey.
Well, being raised in a community where it's predominantly Roman Catholic, you know, kind of the overall view of the Anishinaabe, the old ways, was a little bit looked down on, I think. Most people wanted to forget that. But I see a huge resurgence coming back from the culture. You know, I gained many things from it. And from a young age, I would be immersed in these camps, these language camps and cultural camps. And the people there would bring us up every morning. We would go to the lake and we would do a pipe ceremony for the sun to rise, you know, and we would make our offerings of tobacco. And when that sun is rising, there's a point in there that the elders teach us that all of the world is silent for a second to give praise and thanks to the sun for rising and blessing us another day. You know, and I listened to the sound of the sun rising, you know, to hear, if I could hear all the animals, you know, if they really were silent. So after these camps were over, you know, at the young age, I kept going back to those spots and I kept listening. And, you know, I've become a baker in my life. So I'm up every morning, you know, early morning all the time. And I spend a lot of time with the sun coming up, and that teaching has stuck with me the throughout my whole life, you know, being grateful every day.
It's a beautiful story. What role do stories and storytelling play in the Anishinaabe culture?
They're moral stories and value stories. You know, one of our key figures in the stories is Winnebuju, who is like a trickster hero. And, you know, a lot of ways he teaches us how to live and in a lot of ways how not to live. And as we follow his adventures, you know, they teach us, you know, how to treat each other. They teach us about kindness. They teach us about respect. They teach us about listening to our elders. And, you know, the Anishinaabe culture is embedded in the language. Now, when I talked today, I introduced myself as Bujou, Bape Wagush, Ninijinikaj, but I said in Dunaway, Maganiduk, which means all of my relatives. Now, when we look at that word and we break it down, all of my relatives, that means more than just my brother or my sister or my parents or my grandparents. That's looking at the living spirit within everything, because the Anishinaabe believe that there's a spirit into everything. So when I acknowledge that in Dunaway, Maganiduk, all my relatives, I acknowledge all of it. You know, all the trees, all the plants, all the animals. And I acknowledge that spiritual connection to them. Now, when you have a society of people who all believe that same thing as once everybody did on Turtle Island, you know, we call North America Turtle Island, you had all these people living there believing in that same thing, that everything has a spirit. And when everybody believes that same way, you know, it makes it all that much harder for us to take, you know, that tree you know, has a spirit, it's going to be all that much harder for us to take it. And if we do take it, we take it in a good way, and we offer tobacco, because that tree, that plant, that animal is sacrificing their life for us. They're giving us the gift of life and survival.
What is the significance of tobacco? You've mentioned it 2, 3, 4 times already this morning.
Tobacco is a way that the Anishinaabe use to pray. It was one of the first plants gifted to the earth, and it's a form of currency. When we offer that, we offer, you know, that to the spirit of whatever we're taking, so that because there's in a trade, nothing is free. You know, it's an exchange. And I heard a story growing up too, and this is one of my elders had told me this one, but he said, you know, a long time ago, there was a man, and he was out hunting for the Wawash Geshi, for the deer. He was out hunting, and he took down a deer, you know, and he didn't put down tobacco. You know, this was kind of before the tobacco teaching maybe. And the creator saw this because the spirit of that animal got stuck in between worlds, you know, because there wasn't that tobacco given. There wasn't that sacrifice, you know. And so the creator saw this, and he wanted to teach people to be respectful. So he turned that inini, he turned that man into a Wawash Geshi, into a deer. And for the next year, that man lived his life like a deer. And he ate with them, and he foraged with them, and he stood with them, and he slept with them, and he ended up having a fawn of his own. And one day, while they were out foraging and eating, his young fawn was taken by a hunter. And that's when it really hit him about the power of tobacco, because his young one could not move on to that next place. So he cried, and he cried, and as he stood there, he put his hooves up to his hand, or up to his face, and his hooves turned into hands, and he turned back into a human. And he, saddened by this, you know, he went back to the people that had taken his fawn, and he told them his story, and he told them about tobacco and about its gifts and about how they must give that tobacco so that that spirit may go on. Tobacco has been used by Anishinaabe and indigenous peoples for a really long time here in North America. And, you know, for us in this area, we use, you know, we don't use the chemical tobacco, but we use kinnikinick, which is the inner bark of the red willow. And we take that outer bark off. There's a green layer in there. And you dry that out and you scrape that. And that becomes kinnikinick. That becomes Anishinaabe tobacco. And that's traditionally, that's what we used to pray with, you know. And I know that there's a movement going on where we're trying to decolonize that look on tobacco, you know, for the indigenous people. It's more than just a smoking, you know, kind of thing.
Anishinaabe musician and storyteller Michael Laughing Fox Charette is our guest today on Route 51. As we head into the break, we'll hear some of Michael's poetry. This one is titled Dreams. When we return, we'll explore the relationship between storytelling and music. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Rivers divide on an internal face. Giant rocks moving so slow, seeping cracks roam through time underneath dreams to awaken.
Back on Route 51, I'm Rick Ryer, welcoming listeners to the West Side. Michael Laughing Fox Charette is our guest today. You just heard music from Michael's recording, Tales of Laughing Fox. That was Bamboo Flute. You can email your questions to ideas at WPR.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Michael, who tells the stories in Anishinaabe society and who keeps them alive?
Usually the ones who have that knowledge. You know, as I talked earlier, I gave tobacco to someone who knew the ceremonies. You know, a lot of the Nindamuye, the old women, or the Akuanzi, the old men, you know, they kind of keep those stories. And there's other societies too. You mentioned the Mede Society. You know, I don't know too much about the Medicine Lodge, but that they have a lot of the stories and the creation stories come from there. We also have big drum societies where we go and take part in coming together as a community and celebrating these stories and these the culture, you know, because it was once outlawed.
Well, why is winter the proper time for sharing these stories and telling them?
Winter is a tough time, and I have heard that we only tell certain stories in wintertime when there are certain spirits sleeping. And I know this always confuses the non-Indigenous community, but as a way for us to keep respecting those spirits, you know, we have to keep doing what our teachings tell us to do.
There seems to be, Michael, a really great healing power in these stories. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the stories are old. You know, they go way back, generation upon generation upon generation. They go back so far that we don't even know how far back they go. And when we tell these stories, they're moral stories. They're stories that have, you know, they talk about us how to live life, how to live that minimum modesty when the good life. You know, in the beginning, you know, it was, there was nothing but darkness, and get your money to the creator. He would send out his voice. And it would return without being heard. And in a vision, the creator saw, like, all these galaxies and stars and the planets and the moons and the universe, including the earth. And so he understood that this vision that he had seen had to be, you know, brought to life. So Gitche Moneydu, you know, he filled the earth with oceans, lakes, rivers, all kinds of lands, mountains, plains, forests, deserts. He made four kinds of plants, you know, vegetables, trees, grasses, flowers, and he put them on the earth where they would be most beautiful and most useful. And the creator made all the animal beings. And for the first time, animals flew, walked, and swam the earth. But last, he made the Anishinaabe, and we were created in all sizes, colors, languages, ways of living. And the Anishinaabe were given several gifts that weren't given to plants or animals. And the first one was the ability to dream, to invent ways to make our dreams come true, and also a special gift. Every one of us was given some of the mystery of the creator. And, you know, that kind of begins our journey, you know, and like that kind of story connects us to, you know, not just to each other, but to a world community, because a lot of our creation stories reflect on other people's stories. You know, there's more things connecting us than disconnecting us, you know. And after the creator makes the earth and he brings man down last, everything was going good until they start to fight over resources, you know, and soon you have neighbor against neighbor and brother against brother. And Gitche Moneydu thinks that he has made a mistake, so he wants to cleanse the earth, and he does this with water, and he makes it rain, and it continues to rain and rain and rain until there's no land left, until the animals, the remaining animals in Winnebujou are floating on a log out into this big water. And when we talk about that in our stories, you know, that goes right along with like the flood stories of the, you know, of everybody else's culture. Everybody has some sort of a story like that. And I like to look at these stories and tell my students, you know, this is one of those things that connects us, you know. And yeah. Want to do this? Kind of get lost in my own thoughts there.
That's great. You know, you talk about connection and how these stories connect us to our earth, to each other. What is the reaction that you get when you tell these stories from non-Indigenous people?
Well, most of the times, you know, they're really respectful and they'll listen. And then afterwards, they'll come up and ask more questions. And of course, you know, I don't know like everything. I don't know all the stories. And I come from this village, and somebody from Madison, you know, lives down Milwaukee way, they might not have heard some of the stories that we tell up around Lake Superior, like how the Apostle Islands were created and such. But the stories, you know, like I said, they really teach us how to treat each other or how not to treat each other. And one of the gifts that were given to the people were the seven grandfather teachings. You know, then there's a teaching with each of them. There's love, respect, honesty, humility, courage, wisdom, and truth. And, you know, love, to know love is to know peace. Respect, to honor all creation is to have respect. Honesty in facing a situation is to be brave. Humility is to know yourself as a sacred part of creation. Courage is to face a foe with integrity. Wisdom is to knowledge. To cherish knowledge is to know wisdom. And the truth is to know all these things. And for the wisdom teaching, I like when it says, I heard somebody say, you know, wisdom is to understand and respect the gifts in others, as well as honoring and respecting the gifts in yourself. You know, because we may not be good at everything, but there are things that we are good at. And, you know, when we recognize that, we empower people, you know, because we let them know then that they are special. They are significant to our community and to our family. And, you know, they provide as much as anybody else.
You talked a little bit about just before your students. You mentioned your students and teaching these stories and teaching them the values of your community. I understand that you enlisted the help of some kids in detention to build your first flute. Tell us about that.
Yeah. When I was, you know, when I first started learning to play the flute, I spent 2 years in the woods learning before I made my way to like street corners and such. And as I was on street corners, people would come up and give me these positive reinforcement. The music really made me feel good. I had a bad day and I heard that music and it just alleviated the stresses of that day. And they would ask me questions like, where does the flute come from? And how do you make a flute? So, you know, I didn't have the resources at the time. So I went to the local high school and asked if I could use their facility to create a flute. And they said, sure, as long as you teach five of these kids that are in trouble and, you know, in detention all the time. So, you know, one of them was my nephew. So I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I see where he gets that from. Sure, I'll come in. And I didn't have, like I said, I didn't have material. So I went to the local lumber yard. And behind the local lumber yard, they have this scrap pile of lumber. So I went and I grabbed a couple of cedar 2x6s. And I brought them up to the school. And we made about five flutes out of that. And I talked about stories. And I was in the beginning of my flute making. So I was telling them as much knowledge as I could about the flute that I knew at that time. But we had five working flutes out of there, and I still see those students, you know, here and there. That was about 10 years ago now, you know. So they're still out there, and they still conversate with me whenever we run into each other.
Do you know, do you have any idea what impact that time in the shop room had on them when you were building those flutes?
Well, I know we were all laughing, you know, because I came with the jokes, yeah. You know. I said, oh, bonjour, everybody. And they're like, you know what you think? They said, is your name's Laughing Fox? And I was like, yeah. They said, what are you, a comedian? And then I said, a three-legged dog walks into a bar and he says, I'm looking for the guy who shot my paw.
Okay.
Oh, that's the same reaction they have.
Oh, that's pretty funny. We're talking with Michael Laughing Fox Charette. You can join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. Do the Anishinaabe celebrate the winter solstice? Or are there any other winter traditions that you'd like to talk about?
The winter solstice, you know, the Ojibwe, they have 13 moons. And 13 moons is represented on the back of the turtle shell. The turtle has 13 scales. Every day, like I said, with the sun rising up, every day the Anishinaabe have some sort of ceremony going on. And I know for like the females in our communities do what's known as a grandmother moon ceremony. And all the female of the community get together and they'll pray when the rising of the moon comes up. And we have names, you know, Ojibwe names for everything, of course, and Ojibwe creation stories for everything. You know, we have creation stories why the raccoon wears a mask. We have creation stories of how the Apostle Islands were made. And we even have creation stories on why dogs smell each other's butts. So there's a creation story in everything. And an example of that, like, would be the month of February, which we call the suckerfish moon. And in that story, you know, life is really hard in these stories because they go back so far. They go back to the Ice Age, when the world was forever cold and life was tough. And we relied heavily on our brothers and our animal brothers and sisters, you know, to feed us, to clothe us. So that's like a huge respectful thing that we try to share with them. And in this story, life was really hard for a village. And I've heard a couple different stories about it, but one was that a man in the village had a dream of the suckerfish. And the suckerfish took pity on the people and told them how to put their nets under the ice. And at this time of year, all the other fish are swimming low, you know, and the suckerfish said, we will feed you. And so after he received this vision, he brought this teaching back to his people. And they set nets and they were good. Life was good. You know, they were fed. The suckerfish had given them the ultimate sacrifice and given itself so that we may live. And you will find in the Anishinaabe culture that when we talk about our relationships with our animal brothers and sisters, that, you know, we are highly respectful of them. And that's why in the world, you know, indigenous cultures around the world are kind of leading that charge. They're on the front line of, you know, the environmental stuff that we're dealing with now, that the whole world is dealing with, you know, these communities where they believe in that spirit in everything, you know, and now people are rising up to protect those teachings and protect what is sacred.
We talked about building that flute with your students. I wanted you to share the story about how the flute actually was created, how the Anishinaabe learn to make flutes.
There's a lot of different stories. You know, the flute is one of the oldest instruments out there. It's right up there with the rattle and the drum. The rattle, they believe, is like the big bang. It's the first sound in the universe, is that rattle. The second is the drum, you know, which represents the heartbeat and the heartbeat of Mother Earth, something that we're all connected to. And the third is like the flute. You know, and every culture all across the world has some sort of a flute that they play, and they all have their own creation stories with them. This is one of the stories that I had learned, because the flute is like a healing tool, a healing instrument of unconditional love, and that's why it was created out of love. And a long time ago in this village, there was a young man, and this young man fell in love with this young woman who was of courting age. And he couldn't talk, you know, he didn't have that gift to speak well. So he watched as other young men in the village would bring her gifts or, you know, whatever, what have you. And this kind of frustrated him because he wasn't doing that. You know, he was too shy. So he had heard that in his stories that there was a love medicine. And the spirit that carried this love medicine was the Ayabe, which is a huge albino elk that lives to the west. You know, and he thought to himself that if he could he could find this Ayabe, then somehow he could find this love medicine, and he could give it to this young woman and she would know how he felt about her. So he packed up provisions and he went out into the woods, and he found the biggest set of tracks he could find out there, and he thought to himself, this is it, this has to be the Ayabe. So he started to track it, you know, and days were going by, and he would see flashes, white flashes out of the corner of his eye. And by the time he had his bow and arrow pulled back, it would be gone. And he kept following them deeper and deeper away from his village. And finally, he was exhausted from this traveling and this tracking. He made a huge fire underneath the cedar tree. And he sat there staring into the fire, listening to the crackle and the pop. And he thought about the young woman that he had all these feelings for. And as he started to drift off into sleep, the night song kind of picked up. He went to sleep, and the next day, when he woke up to a knocking. And when he opened his eyes, he looked up into that cedar tree, and he could see a bird on the branch. And that bird was knocking on that branch, knocking holes in that branch. And after it was done, it flew away. And as it flew away, the wind picked up, and it made this sound. He heard that sound and he knew instantly that that's what he was looking for. So he got up, he reached up into that tree and he grabbed a hold of that branch and he broke it off. And as he's looking at that branch, he's trying to figure out how to make it work. So he's blowing on it all different ways, but to no avail, he couldn't figure it out. So he did what was taught to him and he took out some sacred tobacco, some esema, and he said a prayer to the spirit of that bird. And he offered that tobacco to that fire. And that fire turned that tobacco into smoke and brought his prayers up to the spirits. And as he sat there waiting for an answer, he fell back asleep. And in his dream, that bird visited him again. And he asked him, what is it that you seek? And the young man told him his dilemma. He told him about his heart's desire. He told him about the other young men in the village. And as the bird listened to him, you know, he felt bad for him and he took pity on him. And he started to tell the young man how to create that sound, how long to make that flute, where to put the holes. And he said, always remember when you play this to keep the image of your heart's desire in your mind, and you feel it in your heart, in your chichagwan. And when you blow it out into this flute, this bibiguan, it'll come out the end and it'll wabiguan, it'll flower. The Ojibwe word for flower is wabiguan. The Ojibwe word for flute is bibiguan. Two words connected. And as he created this first flute, he went back to his village and he stood up on a hill and he was looking down. He could see everybody working in his village, you know. Some people were dancing wild rice. Some people were picking berries. Some people were drying out meat. And some people were smoking fish. And as he stood up on top of that hill, he closed his eyes and he started to play with the image of his heart's desire where the spirits had told him to play from. That music made its way down from that hill and into the village. And everybody that was busy doing something stopped because nobody had ever heard a sound like that before. They all stopped and they all turned to the sound. Finally, that sound made its way to the wigwam, the home of the young woman. And as soon as she heard that sound, she knew instantly that that was for her. And she came out of her wigwam and she looked up to the source of the sound and she could see the young man standing up on that hill. And she always wondered why he never came and talked to her. And she went up and she stood next to this young man and she closed her eyes. And as she listened, She was so overwhelmed and amazed that somebody could express so much love without uttering a single word. And as he played, she realized that the music was intertwining their souls together.
Michael Laughing Fox Charette is our guest today on Route 51. He's here to share his rich story, traditions of the Anishinaabe. When we return, we'll talk about the history and resurgence of teaching the original Ojibwe Mohan language. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. And as we head into the break, we now hear another poem from Michael Butterfly.
Butterfly fluttering underneath my lids, your wings make echoes throughout the world. I watch you slowly flow by, letting my troubles travel with you. Free flowing in the wind, forever touching a pale canvas with the tips of beautifully colored wings. I once glimpsed a woman with your wings tattooed upon her face, a dancing spirit who inspired a plant to bloom a flower. Sweet, sweet nectar dripped from its petals and landed on the back of my hand.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. Michael Laughing Fox Charette is our guest today. Do you have a question about our Anishinaabe neighbors or about storytelling traditions? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Michael, how did the stories told by other cultures differ from those told by the Anishinaabe?
Well, you know, earlier we were talking about how the flood story matches up with other cultures all around the world. And, you know, these stories go way back. You know, they're passed on from generation to generation to generation. And they go so far back that we don't even know how far back they go. And when we start getting into our storytelling, you know, we talk about that time when the world was forever cold and unforgiving. And, you know, that brings up the point of, you know, the ice age, you know, and for around the Great Lakes region and Lake Superior, I believe, you know, there was people living in these areas, you know, around the time of the melting of the ice age. So you're looking at 11,000 years ago. And there have been people living in around Lake Superior and in that area ever since. But it's an oral tradition. It's a living history. And it's something, you know, that's passed on. And the stories differ sometimes from village to village. And, you know, I do apologize if I'm telling stories, you know, out there in that that some of the other communities haven't heard yet, maybe, or just have different versions of.
Well, you have another story to share with us, something that isn't from the oral tradition, but something that happened to you in an airport related to your playing and how the music drew people together that you did not expect.
Yeah, you know, after playing a couple of years in the woods and moving to street corners and talking to people, you know, and them and having those kind words of encouragement, I started to play at other places like bus stops and airports. And I really love playing at the airports because of the fact that people are going from point A to point B so quickly that they don't take that time in that moment to slow down, you know, and appreciate what they're going through. So I like to say my flute journey is like a musical experiment. And there I was in the airport playing, you know, and no matter where these people were from, what culture they were from, that flute music made them slow down. And just like in the flute playing story where everybody stops to listen, that was the same thing that was happening to me at these airports. People were slowing down and coming over and listening. And when I play, I close my eyes and I go right back to the place where I learned the flute, which is the woods. You know, so when I'm back there and I shut my eyes. And as I'm doing this at this airport in Philadelphia, I was there on Christmas Eve. And I had the flight wasn't leaving until the next day. So I had to spend the night there, which was kind of cool because I'm from the Northwoods, you know, and I'm in a big city and checking things out. So as I'm sitting there playing, you know, I noticed all kinds of people from Japan, people from Russia, people from Australia, all stopping. And I'm playing my flute like that. And I go into this zone for about 2 hours. And I open my eyes up and there's a ring of people around me. And these people, you know, I notice them, like their clothes were dirty. They look kind of tired. You know, I could kind of smell them. And I realized, you know, that they were all homeless, you know, people. And I was just thinking, you know, wow, this flute music kind of brought us together. And one guy from the crowd comes up to me and he says, "Hey, man. My name's Curtis. That's good flute playing." And I was like, "Hey, thanks, Curtis. My name is Laughing Fox." And he gave me this really weird look. And he said, "How did you know my name was Curtis?" And this kind of freaked me out because I'm from the Northwoods. I haven't had interactions like that. You know, and it made me wonder how these people got into their situation, where their families were at. You know, I could tell maybe some mental issues going on, you know. And then I thought again, the flute had brought us all together for this time. It didn't matter who they were or where they were from, but the music had called us together. And the flute that I was playing was a double drone flute. So that means there's two flutes in one. And I like to tell my students that, you know, individually, you know, we sound good, but when we work together, we can even make even more beautiful things happen. And this song doesn't have a title, only that story to it. Thank you.
Thank you for playing that, Michael. It's a beautiful instrument. And in that story that you shared with us in the airport, really does prove, if you will, that music is a universal language of just bringing people together, whether it's for healing or just to be together in that particular moment. So thank you for that. One of the other things I did want to talk with you about is similar to that. It's one of the things that defines a culture is its language. And would I be correct in saying that the Ojibwe Mauan language is endangered?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was outlawed. Our culture was outlawed for a long time. And it wasn't until 1968 that we actually had freedom of speech. And it wasn't until 1978 that we actually had freedom of religion. And, you know, that was only 43 years ago for freedom of religion and 53 years ago for freedom of speech. Before that, you have generations of silence and you have generations where, you know, the Anishinaabe people were told, you know, that being Indian was a bad thing. You know, doing the ceremonies are a bad thing. That's pagan. That's the devil. That's, you know, savage. Those are, you know, this and that, you know, and that's kind of like a false narrative. You know, it's like that whole thing of, you know, people, you know, believing that if it wasn't for the settlers, then the Indians would just kill each other off. You know, if it wasn't for us, you'd all still be living in teepees. You know, I've heard that kind of stuff throughout my whole life, you know, and that's like a false narrative, because you have a people who carry around tools with them called peace pipes. You know, what type of warring society of people would carry around these tools? And when we met another culture, you know, we would sit down and we would smoke these pipes before negotiations, connecting our spirits and saying that with this one breath, we're making one prayer together. So it was really a beautiful culture, and it just really was misunderstood. You know, and a lot of really rugged and tough things had happened to the people over the last, you know, 500 years. But we are still here. And we still speak our language, and we still tell our stories. And today, you know, using this traditional technology, you know, it's sought after, because we were able to do what we can't do today with all our technology. With all our technology, we can't do today, and that's live in balance and in harmony with Mother Earth. In a lot of the times, these stories teach us how to live in balance. The seven grandfather teachings were given to the people so that they could live in balance, and that they were guides to Mino Bamatisi Win, which in the Anishinaabe language means the good life. You know, and that's something that we all strive to reach for. We're all human, and we all want to love and be loved.
In the last few seconds that we have in the program, Michael, we opened the segment with a piece of music you entitled Ndeyake, the name of your daughter. What are your hopes for her and her generation?
Ndeyake, I wanted things to be different with her, so we had a home birth. We even gave her an Indian name right away. We did ceremonies with the afterbirth, and we wanted her to go life in a good way. So when we were thinking about names, we called her Ndeyake, meaning my heart of the earth, because we wanted to show our friends and neighbors and our peers how beautiful the language is, instead of calling somebody like Michael. You know, I understand Michael sounds pretty cool to me, but there's so many Michaels out there in the world. We could wrap around the world twice. Unfortunately, 2/3 of us would perish because of the water. Ndeyake, you know, we look at ourselves. I would hope that the future generations would look to their own education and consider themselves global citizens. Look beyond your country. Look beyond your own backyard. Because to celebrate diversity is a really good thing. But what Mother Earth really needs now is unity.
Michael Laughing Fox Charette, thank you so much for being with us on Route 51 today. That's all the time we have. That's all the time we have for today on Route 51. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.